Me. Yay, everyone pay attention to me now. Hi, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Welcome to it. Very happy to have you here. Hey, chat room guys. How the hell are you guys this morning? Got the chat room guys in the chat room. You guys could be chat room guys too. Just stop by scotthorton.org/chat. You want to hang out in there? Say hi to the good people. Good, good. See, JDA2000's doing good, man. Right on. Hope everybody had a good weekend. I got a good show lined up for you today. Did you see the spotlight today on antiwar.com? Aw, man. It's horrible. That's why I chose it to be the spotlight. It's very well written. It's just, it's about the Israelis murdering Gazans. Destroying people's private property. Their sacred right to their private property. And it's just horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. America's, well, yeah, Freudian slip there, kinda. I was gonna say America's the largest open-air prison there, the Gaza Strip, but then, no, it's Israel's. America's largest open-air prison would be, what, the Navajo Reservation or something like that, right? Or just Texas. I don't know. Yeah, Gaza Strip. Seems like, I don't know what they should do about it, but I'm pretty sure humanity should do something about it. That's kind of my feeling on that. Yeah. Jen Marlowe on the show, a great piece today at tomdispatch.com and at antiwar.com. And then Robert Stinnett will be here on the show. Robert Stinnett is the author of the book Day of Deceit. Yeah, nice screw up twice in a row there. I was going to say The Day of Deceit, and then, but it's not, it's just Day of Deceit. And then I was going to leave off the, when, no, it belongs on the subtitle. I'm really bad at talking. I need another cup of coffee. Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. FDR, the great dictator. FDR, fascist president for life. Who lied you into war. So Robert Stinnett's going to be on about that. He's the man that proved the case. Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit. And Jason Leopold is going to be on the show to talk about the torture report, which they said was going to come out today. I think he had a source saying it was going to come out today, and then other journalists piggybacked on that and said, yeah, that's what I heard too, kind of thing. Of course, Jason's out in front on this stuff, as always. Then I read a thing that said that there might be a delay. We're still, of course, only talking about the classified, sanitized, redacted summary of the torture report, which only looked at a narrow set of questions about the torture program. It's even at the full report at almost 7,000 pages is still far short of the complete story. It was never meant to be. Focuses only on the CIA. It leaves out Donald Rumsfeld's torture entirely. Entirely. And it leaves out the president and his war cabinet and all their lawyers who were the guilty criminal felon conspirators who conspired to break the law and torture people. That's not in there either. It's based on some narrow questions. But then again, you know, I don't know. I want to read the damn thing. Release it then already. And, you know, there's been a campaign to try to get this outgoing Senator Mark Udall from, what, Wyoming? To go ahead, he was defeated in the last election, a Democrat. He's Ron Wyden's friend in the Senate, sort of a civil libertarian Democrat type. And people are saying, hey, man, why don't you do like Mike Gravel? You're a senator, still, for a minute. Get up there and read the damn thing. They can't stop you. That's in the Constitution. For some reason, the consensus in D.C. is that that part of the Constitution actually counts. They get to pick and choose whichever parts of the Constitution they want, of course, on any given subject. But apparently, when it comes to the privileges of a senator to go ahead and release classified information on the Senate floor, he cannot be stopped by the executive branch due to the speech is it the speech and debate clause or the speech or debate clause? Anyway, they're privileged from arrest except for breach of the peace, an immediate arrest necessary to secure the safety of others, that kind of thing. Otherwise, they have that kind of immunity because it's part of the checks and balances so that the Senate does not serve at the pleasure of the president. That's why it's like that. And so that's why he's protected. And some are saying, go ahead and do it. I guess he's not going to. I guess we'll get the kind of redacted version here or something if we're lucky. But it is what it is. So there you go. Jen Marlowe on Gaza. Robert Stinnett on the great dictator, Franklin Roosevelt. And Jason Leopold on the torture report. Here's the part of the show where I say, hey, you like the show, you should help support it. The number one most best way to help support the show is to sponsor the show. I work real cheap. But yes, my advertisers, they like me, man. I do them some good. I've been selling some vitamins for Whole Food Multicomplete. I've been selling some coffee for Darren's Coffee. I've been selling subscriptions for the Future Freedom Foundation to their great journal, The Future of Freedom. I think, you know. I don't know. It's worth a try. Give me some money and I will talk about the thing that you sell. See if we can put together a little bit of a mutually beneficent exchange in the tradition of, you know, libertarian capitalists and stuff. The second best way to support the show is to donate to the show. I'm trying to figure out a way to call it a subscription and figure out what to give you for it, a t-shirt, whatever. I'm working on it. I'm really lousy at being a businessman, okay? You can call it a subscription if you want, but I give away everything free. All of my archives going back to 2003, you can have for free because that's the way I like to do it. They're all there in MP3 format for you. But if you want to, you know, kind of museum style suggested donation at the door is $10,000 million, but whatever you can do is okay. And if you donate $100 or more, I will send you a commodity disc. And that is a 1 ounce fine silver piece with a QR code on the back. It doesn't have a face value. That's why I never liked Bernard von Notthaus. Now, what the federal government did to him was horrible. I'm not saying that they should exist or anything. But what I never liked about von Notthaus's Liberty Dollar was that he put a face value on it. And when I interviewed him, I was like, yeah, Liberty Dollar guy, cool. And then when I was talking to him was when I decided I didn't like it. It seemed to me unfair if silver's trading at $11 for you to write $20 on the front. It seems like that's just a scam to screw over the shopkeeper who believes it's worth $20, but it's really not. I never did like that, and I always complained about it. And Arlo Pignatti said, you know what, dude? Let's put a QR code on the back. You scan the QR code with your phone, you get the instant spot price. It doesn't have a face value. It has a real market value in real time. Whatever it is, you scan it right there. And, you know, I think it's the greatest currency in the history of mankind. Are you kidding me? Silver coins that basically talk to you and tell you exactly how much they're worth on the open market in a verifiable way? I mean, that's the greatest thing ever, ever, man. CommodityDiscs.com. And I'll send you one if you donate $100 or more. But you ought to just go buy 10,000 of them from Arlo, man. I mean, I think this thing is the greatest thing ever, dude. The QR code commodity disc. Now, I think, you know, if we add a free market, that would eventually be the one world currency and wouldn't be controlled by an evil central bank. It would just be metal in the marketplace like Murray Rothbard would want it. All right. Yeah, so there's that. Support the show. ScottHorton.org/donate or ScottHorton.org/support or Scott@ScottHorton.org if you want to email me about maybe advertising on the show. Okay, now, oh no, look at the clock. I have so little time. Let me tell you about yesterday's interview. Is the music playing? Oh, it's playing. Yesterday's interview, it's on the website, ScottHorton.org. It was Neboj Samalich on the KPFK show, all about the war in Ukraine and the oil pipeline wars and stuff. You'll really like it. Check it out, ScottHorton.org/interviews. Neboj Samalich from antiwar.com. Back in just a sec. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. All right, kids, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah. Nebojsa. That's what I was saying before the break there. Nebojsa Malic, he writes for antiwar.com and has for a very long time, and one hell of an archive there. And I admit, I don't read him all the time except for when there's some kind of crisis in Eastern Europe, because I can't tell my Hungary from my Bosnia and whatever. I don't freaking know, man. I should. What I ought to do is lock myself in a room for a week and read everything he ever wrote for antiwar.com for the last 15 years or 10 or 12 or whatever it is. And then ask myself what I think I know about it at the end. He's good on everything. What can I say? He's great. And so I interviewed him all about the Ukraine and, the coup d'etat there. I made him basically retell the history of the last year and America's overthrow of the democratically elected government of Ukraine and the crisis that that's led to and, you know, undoing in every sense the American government and media's narrative about what's going on there. And then he also talked about, and this is, you know, like I said at the beginning of the interview, it's certainly burying the lead. I made him wait till the end to talk about the pipelines. And what it is as he explained, which I'll go ahead and ruin it for you, the Russians were trying to build a pipeline. And the Americans and the Europeans got the Bulgarians to back out of the deal. Even though it was in their own interest to go ahead and do it. And so that was the South Stream pipeline. And Putin said, oh, I don't care, that's fine, I'll just build a pipeline to Turkey instead. And I'm not certain what the reaction was. I don't know. Is there a proper page at the State Department website where you can find their latest gasps of shock and horror? Do they kind of live blog their failures on a regular basis or what there? But looks like they're pushing Turkey into Russia's arms here, which is interesting because, boy, are they on opposite sides of the war in Syria, for example. But I don't know. I guess, you know, Nebojsa said, he paraphrased that old Henry Kissinger quote about how it is dangerous to be America's enemy. It's absolutely fatal to be our friend. And maybe Erdogan has figured out that, man, the closer I am to the Americans, the more likely they are to kill me. I ought to go ahead and cozy up to the Russians and you know, I don't know. I mean, what is this going to mean for the future of the NATO alliance, that whole project of trying to integrate Turkey into the European Union and all that? What does it mean for the larger alliance with, supposed alliance with Turkey in the Middle East, where already, for example, we have such a hard time, supposedly, at least, getting them to cooperate with American goals on ISIS. Now that America's changed their goals on ISIS, you understand. But anyway, man, that's a hell of a thing. So the Russians said, oh, fine, you got me, you beat me. I guess I'll just have to make a deal with the Turks instead. And the Americans got took again because they suck at being imperialists. Great interview. And by the way, yeah, it was the Americans that overthrew the government there and created the entire crisis. And every single thing that they said to you about how Putin is this Ronchevist trying to recreate the old Russian Empire of the Tsars, if not the Soviet Empire of Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler or, you know, whatever. Hillary said, well, this is just like what Hitler did in Czechoslovakia in 1938. Yeah, actually, no, it's not. as Putin put it in, not his last speech, but a couple of speeches ago, you know, we thought about it. He was being kind of cute about it. You know, we thought about it. Would we like to go down to Sevastopol to visit our friends in NATO at their new naval base there? Where we've had a naval base since the days of the American Articles of Confederation? Before George Washington was ever the president? You know what? We thought about it and we decided that actually, no. As much as we love our friends in the NATO navies, and we love them, we decided that actually we did not want to visit them at their new base in Crimea. We decided that, no, we'll keep it. Thanks. What do you think is going to happen? Give me a break. Yeah, some invasion. Not one shot fired in anger the entire time. Some invasion. The troops that conquered the Crimean Peninsula were already there. They had a lease to keep the base. And it was full of sailors and Marines anyway. Whatever the Russians call their Marines. All they did was leave their bases and lock the place down. And say, Kiev, American-backed Nazi government, get the hell out. And that's another part of that interview that you'll want to hear is Nebojsa talking about the Nazis involved that America used and have gained in power tremendously in Ukraine since the coup of last February. There are right-wing nationalists all over the world. There are right-wing nationalists that just came to power in India, right? But nobody says that they're outright Nazis. They go, whoa, those guys are like kinda, sorta Hindu Nazis in a way or something, right? But they don't go, they're Nazis. They go, well, they're kinda neo-Nazis or they're right-wing Hindu nationalists, hardcore ones, man. But to call someone just Nazi without any kind of prefix or, you know, disclaimer, you gotta mean something really specific, right? Well, in the case of the thing in Ukraine, I mean, I guess you could call them neo-Nazis, but really, no, they're just Nazis. They're the grandsons and the sons of Nazis. And they proudly parade around with their Nazi insignia, and they told the BBC that they want a clean country. Not like Hitler. Well, a little bit like Hitler. Yeah. Which means what? Means kick out everybody who's not part of the ethnic in-group. That's what that means. And the Svoboda Party, that means freedom, its old name was the Social Nationalists. The Right Sector Battalion, they proudly march with their SS lightning bolts and their Wolfsangel Nazi symbol of their fathers who fought for the Waffen-SS. Who fought for the Gestapo and murdered Jews and Poles and, I forget, Nebojsa named other ethnic groups, other ethnic minorities that were targeted. You know, my wife's family, she has family, she's descended from family who survived the Nazi Holocaust in Ukraine by the skin of their teeth. At the hands of these guys. And these are their proud sons. That America, that, may, do I need to point out? Jewish neoconservatives in America primarily have championed and helped to put into power here. What the hell? And they've gotten away with that. They have gotten away with that, with backing real, no-fooling, Hitler-loving Nazis. Go read Robert Perry about it at Consortium News. Read Nebojsa Malik. Check him out at scotthorton.org/interviews, yesterday's KPFK show. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate y'all tuning in. Coming up in half an hour, Robert Stinnett. But first, it's Jen Marlowe. She's got this piece at tomdispatch.com, and we're running it today at antiwar.com as the spotlight as well. One family, two doors. Nowhere to Run. Welcome to the show, Jen. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thanks, Scott, for having me. How you doing?
I really appreciate you joining us. And now I'm paging down because I realize that I don't have your whole bio, but here it is. It says, human rights activist, author, documentary filmmaker, and founder of Donkey Saddle Projects. Her books include I Am Troy Davis and The Hour of Sunlight, One Palestinian's Journey from Prisoner to Peacemaker. She's also, her films include Witness Bahrain. Ooh, that's a whole other interview you and I are going to have to do. And One Family in Gaza. The blog is donkeysaddle.wordpress.com. Great. I'm glad I remembered to page down there. So wonderful
I
article.
Otherwise.
I'm sorry.
I said I would have reminded you otherwise.
Oh, okay. Well, good. Yeah, you got to stick up for yourself, man. All right. So now listen, this is just horrible. So I'm going to be quiet and let you tell the story. Please, if you would, the Awaja family. Great article. I don't mean horrible article. I mean horrible subject matter. Wonderfully written story here.
Thank you. It's, you know, the power of the story just really tells itself. And I was honored to be able to be a vehicle for the family. But I met the Awaja family in Gaza in August of 2009, which was several months after the first Gaza war that Israel, termed Operation Cast Lead. And when I met the family, their home had just been destroyed in Operation Cast Lead, and their 9-year-old son had been killed in a very brutal way. And the whole family, including the smaller children, witnessed the execution-style murder of their 9-year-old son and brother. So I met them in 2009, a few months after that, about 6 months after that, and the family was living in a tent near the rubble of their destroyed home. And I had a video camera with me, although I did not come to Gaza intending to make a film, but I had brought my camera with me. But after meeting this family and hearing their story, I felt compelled to use the camera as a platform for them to tell their story to a wider audience. And what moved me so much was not only the trauma and the horror that they had lived through, but also the parents' determination to be able to create a future for their surviving children. Their love for their children came shining through so greatly, and their belief in nonviolence, their struggling to help their children heal from the trauma that they had lived through, that spoke volumes. And the film featured not only the tragedy, the story of their tragedy, but also the story of this family trying to rebuild and help their children heal. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2009. And that film I made based on that was called One Family in Gaza. And through this one family story, it was a lens into the wider story of what all families in Gaza were enduring. And I stayed in touch with the families in the years since then.
Okay, now stop right there for just one second. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to say real quick, I'm sorry. I read the Word document and approved it, and I never got a chance. I only just realized that the videos are actually embedded here in the article. It's the spotlight again today at antiwar.com. You can watch both movies there, One Family in Gaza and The Update. They're both embedded in the actual article. So I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to watch them before the show. I only read the article, but I can't wait to see them. So that's an important point I wanted to bring up for the audience. And then secondly, I just wanted to clarify on one point of fact, if I could. When you mentioned the killing of the 9-year-old son, you called it execution style. And I wonder if you could be specific of whether, you know, what exactly happened in that situation.
Absolutely. And I can tell it to you as the parents told it to me. The family had been in their home. It was 2 a.m. on January 4th, and the Operation Cast Lead had started a week before that as an air bombardment campaign. And on the morning of January 4th is when the ground invasion began. And the family, the 12-year-old daughter woke her parents up. She had seen soldiers outside the house, and the family lit candles to put in the window of their house to show that the house was occupied by a family, to let the soldiers know that. And yet, very soon after that, the house began to crumble literally on top of the family's head, and they realized a military bulldozer was pushing the house down. And so they grabbed their children, the smallest ones, and they fled the house. The next morning after they returned to see that their house had been totally destroyed, all of a sudden gunfire surrounded the family again. And the 9-year-old boy, Ibrahim, was shot non-fatally, as the family was fleeing, and the mother and the father were also shot non-fatally. The father, after 9-year-old Ibrahim was shot, the father scooped him up as they began to run. And then the mother, who was hit in both of her hips with bullet fire, she managed to get the other kids behind a mud brick wall. But Kamal, who was hit in the chest, had fallen in the road and was holding 9-year-old Ibrahim in his arms. At that point, a soldier approached on foot and at close range, shot 9-year-old Ibrahim in the face, according to what both parents told me. The father pretended to be dead, and that might have been why the soldier didn't shoot him as well. And the mother, the soldier actually turned towards the mother who was trying to protect the other children, and she screamed, you know, you've already killed the father and the son, please spare the rest of the children. And the soldiers retreated at that point. And so Wafa had actually thought, the mother had actually thought that her husband had been killed as well. In reality, Kamal was still alive, but his 9-year-old son, who was in his arms, had just been murdered.
So it's not, you know, it's easy to kind of fill in gaps sometimes and imagine, well, there must have been a firefight with some Hamas terrorists and the little boy just happened to be nearby, or some kind of made up thing that people like to tell themselves. But so anyway, I think it's important to nail down those details. And then, so one of the things that you mentioned was, well, I mean, as you just described, the whole family was there, the ones that, who survived, saw what happened. And you talk at length in the article about the trauma that they've suffered and what their lives are like now after seeing the Israeli so-called defense forces murder this 9-year-old boy, their brother, right in front of their face like this, destroy their house like this.
And that's really what the film focuses on, and so much of what the article focuses on is the aftermath, because I think so often we only pay attention to a situation at the moment of the acute trauma, at the moment of an attack, at the moment of an invasion. But what happens afterwards when the tanks finally do leave and the guns are silent, and then the attention turns and we never see what it's like for the families living in the aftermath of that, and how long and how profound and how deep the impact of that trauma is. And that was what I was hoping to reveal with the film. And as I stayed in touch with the family and saw the ways in which that impact and that trauma continued over time and over years, and then of course with new and fresh trauma added to that, to me that was a very powerful window into what all people in Gaza are living through and are enduring. And it's something we don't see, because we only pay attention, if we pay attention to Gaza, it's only when rockets are flying out of Gaza, targeting Israeli communities near Gaza, or when the shelling and the tanks and the warplanes are shelling Gaza.
Right. All right. Now, so we've only got about 30 seconds before we have to take this break. So when we get back from the break, we'll talk all about the aftermath, and I'd like to give you a chance to, if you could, give us a little bit of kind of, you know, description, anecdotes, the way you do in the article about the way that the children act out, that kind of thing. Make it feel real for people, because, well, you know, we're all victims of American TV here. People in the Gaza Strip, you got to really make them human, or they just don't seem real to the average American, I think. Anyway, Jen Marlow on the other side of this break. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jen Marlowe. She's the author of this great piece at TomDispatch.com and at Antiwar.com today. It's called One Family, Two Doors, Nowhere to Run. And you can find her original documentary here, One Family in Gaza, and the follow-up, both videos embedded in the article today as well. So I will urge you to look at it. And so, yeah, I was hoping, Jen, that you could tell us a little bit about, you know, the way you quote the mom here explaining the children's psychological problems that they have now and trying to grapple with living in an Israeli prison like this.
Absolutely. And the signs of trauma were evident in the children right after the violence that they endured, the acute violence that they endured in 2009. And a particularly poignant example of that that the family told me about was one of the things that the family endured after their home was destroyed and the 9-year-old boy was killed. The parents were both injured. They had no way to get any help and they ended up hiding underneath the rubble of their destroyed home, underneath the collapsed ceiling for about 4 days without any food or any clean water. And the mother described for me how 9 months after that, their 3-year-old son, whose name is Dia, still went to sleep holding a loaf of bread, clutching a loaf of bread in his arms. And if you tried to take it from him as he was sleeping, he would wake up and hold it tighter and say, no, it's mine. The experience of such deprivation made this little boy have to go to sleep hugging a loaf of bread. And the trauma for the children, their nightmares, their fears, their insecurity persisted. And when I saw the family the next time after I had originally filmed with them in 2009, it was in 2012. And they were at that moment finally rebuilding their destroyed home after 3 years of living in tents and impermanent housing situations. They were finally rebuilding their home. And the mother told me something that took my breath away. She told me that as they were making the plans to rebuild the home, the children were insisting that the home be built with two doors. And when the parents asked, you know, why two doors, the kids wanted one door. That was just the regular door to enter and exit the house. And the second door as an escape door so that when the Israelis destroyed their home again, they would have a door to escape from. And the parents kept trying to reassure the children, nothing like this is going to happen. We're going to be safe. We're going to be okay. And the children kept insisting, no, Daddy, two doors. We need two doors in our house so that we can run away.
Right. Okay. Now, before we get to what happened right after that, then I just wanted to mention this one thing. This is the one that really got me. It reminded me of my young nephews and stuff. You know, people who have young males in their family. If you can picture a little kid, who, as it says here, when he kisses you, you can feel the violence in his kiss. He kisses you and then he pushes you away. He might punch or slap you. So this is a kid who's how old? What, 5 or 6 years old or something?
Well, he was 3 years old at that time.
Oh, yeah, right.
He's a little bit older.
So imagine that 3-year-old kid who he's so screwed up, he just can't even hug right. He's just completely broken.
Yeah, he's internalized so much all of the violence he's experienced that even when he's trying to show affection, it comes out as violence. And this is a 3-year-old child who his only playground was the rubble of his destroyed home. I filmed him and his 5-year-old sister, and you'll see this in the film, you know, climbing and jumping on their collapsed roof, rolling bullet shells and, you know, and shrapnel down the slope of their collapsed roof. And that was their only playground.
All right. So then they rebuilt the house and with two doors, right?
Well, I think they probably built the house with one door. I'm not sure if they.
Oh, I thought they actually had gone ahead and said, okay, you know, we have to.
You know, I'm not sure because I actually never had the chance to see the new house and I never will have the chance to see the new house because tragically the children were presciently correct about their fear that the home would be destroyed again. Because they built the house. It was completed in 2013. In February of 2014, they finished the final step, which was putting glass in the windows. And just that a few months later, this past summer, July 2014, the next most recent Gaza war began. And the entire neighborhood evacuated, the entire neighborhood where the Awaja family lives. And one day in the midst of the war, when there was a humanitarian ceasefire, the father, Kamal, was able to get back to the house to see what had happened. And he found that in house, his house and indeed the entire neighborhood had been completely demolished once again. So the home that they had finally rebuilt to try to provide for their children some modicum of safety, some modicum of security, was once again a pile of rubble.
Right. And then so now what are they doing? They're just living on the rubble?
They are living in a tent next to the rubble of their home and trying to get to their for their children the basic needs. Initially, in the first couple of weeks after they returned back to the home, they had literally nothing but the tent, nothing but the nothing to separate them from the ground except for the nylon of the tent. No mattresses, no blankets. The children were sleeping outside at night, even when even in the cold at night. So I've been able to send the family some support, and there's actually, if you follow the link in the article, there's an Indiegogo campaign that I set up on behalf of the family so folks can help me in sending the family some ongoing support. And so far with that support, they've been able to get a little gas stove to cook with, because in those initial weeks, the mother, the only thing she had to cook over was wood that she was scavenging from the remains of her home. She would make cook over an open fire that was made from the wood she scavenged from her destroyed home. Now the family has a little gas stove to cook with. They've been able to get some beds for the kids. But they're still in a tent. They've been able to get to make some kind of bathroom facility so that the hygiene situation's not quite as bad as it was in the first weeks when they were back and there was no water and there was no bathroom facility. So slowly they're trying to put together some infrastructure for survival. But of course, survival alone is a far cry from being able to live a life of dignity, with security, with freedom, with safety, and that's what the people in Gaza are desperately need. Yes, they need their homes rebuilt, and yes, they need food, and yes, they need water, but they need more than all of that, the ability to build a future for themselves and for their children. Yeah. And that can only happen, not with humanitarian aid, but with the end of the Israeli occupation and the end of the ongoing siege.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Freedom only can provide for that. And the thing is here, too, is this story that you're telling, this absolute nightmare, is this is a story that's just replicated over and over and over again, thousands and thousands of times across. I just saw a tweet, I retweeted, I don't know how accurate this is or the source, what the hell, but it says 77 family lines eliminated, 2,260 people killed, more than 10,000 injured, 1,800 orphaned. This is a war on a society. They talk about pinprick strikes on Hamas and whatever, and it's just a damned lie.
Yeah, in the pinpricks, on those pinprick strikes on Hamas, said in quotes, in the 2014 assault alone, those pinprick strikes killed over 500 children. And if you add the number of children that were killed, including in the 2009 and 2012, and 2014 combined, it's 872 children in Gaza who were killed. In those same three assaults, there was also, from mortar fire coming from Gaza, there was also a three-year-old little Israeli boy who was killed. And that death is a tragedy. That death of that Israeli boy should never have happened. It's inexcusable and indefensible. That Israeli child had the absolute right to grow up with safety and security and to build a future for himself and to have dreams and to accomplish those dreams. That child's life is incredibly important. But that child's life is not more important than the 872 children in Gaza who were killed and whose families are living with the devastation of that. And I think we as a society, there's a real imbalance, not only in the power, the military power and the political power between Israelis and Palestinians, but in the value that we accord human lives. We accord Israeli lives so much more worth than Palestinian lives. And of course, those lives are equally valuable. And until we recognize the equal humanity of all children, Israeli and Palestinian, this is doomed to continue.
That's Jen Marlowe. Her new piece is at tomdispatch.com and antiwar.com. One Family, Two Doors, Nowhere to Run. Go and read that. The movie is One Family in Gaza and the update. Both videos are embedded in this article. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Thank you so much, Jen.
Thanks, Scott. It was really great to have the chance to discuss with you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. The 8th of December. Can you believe it? Already. 2014. That means yesterday was Pearl Harbor Day. I try every year, if I can, almost every year, I interview the great Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, which was published in 1999. And finally made the case that many had long suspected, including John T. Flynn, going way back to the very beginning, that the government in Washington, D.C. knew a lot more than they let on about the oncoming Pearl Harbor attack and turned a blind eye, really deliberately provoked it, and then turned a blind eye and allowed the attack to take place. Again, the book is Day of Deceit, and you can find tons of source material and background and research and interviews and all sorts of expanded materials at independent.org. That's the website of the Independent Institute, where Mr. Stinnett is a fellow. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Very happy to have you back on the show. So let's start, as we always do, with your time in the U.S. Navy.
Yes, I was... in the U.S. Navy from 1942 to 1946, I was attached to the Pacific Fleet in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm. And now, so where were you, say, for, you know, at the end of the war? Were you to be part of the invasion force of Japan or something like that?
No, the... I was ship's company on the aircraft carrier San Jacinto, and we were part of the offensive arm of the Pacific Fleet. And after the Japanese surrendered, or about to surrender, our ship was sent back to Alameda, California. We had been out for about 2 years.
Oh, I see. Okay, right. So. Now we fast forward to, I believe, the very early 1980s, correct? And then you were, someone drew your interest back to the story of the attack at Pearl Harbor. How's that?
Yeah, that's right. I had read a book called At Dawn We Slept, excuse me, and it said that the U.S. Navy had a monitoring station that was intercepting the Japanese Navy's instructions to all their warships. And I thought that would be a good 1982 article on Pearl Harbor Day. And I worked for the Oakland Tribune at that time, and the editor agreed, and he sent me over to Honolulu to see what this intercept station was all about. And so we were the first American newspaper or media to be admitted to the intercept station. But the Japanese company had done it about a month before. But when I met the cryptographers at that time, and they told me how they were intercepting the Japanese naval information that was broadcast on Japanese Morse code.
Mm-hmm. And now, I guess the story had always been that, well, yes, they'd broken the diplomatic codes, but the diplomats weren't in the loop on the attack, and so that was it. But so what you were finding out then in the 1980s was incredibly shocking. They had this entire separate source of information on military communications that they had always lied and said never existed, even up to that day, right?
Yes, that is correct. That was the first I had heard about we were breaking the Japanese military code, the Japanese Navy's military code.
Mm. And then, so now, it took you a long time to get the book together. Did you start writing it way back then, and you just had to wait to get all the proper documents?
Well, you know, I believed our story that it was a surprise attack. So this was a major new development, and so I wanted to check it out, and my editor sent me over to Pearl Harbor, and I filed a Freedom of Information Act with the Navy, and they opened up the quarters. The building was still existed, but it had a different use. But while I was there, I met some of the cryptographers, and they told me where I would be able to find other information, which I did, but it took 5 or 6 years where I actually was able to substantiate all the information.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I know it's terribly unfair to do this in a format like this, but is there a way that you can briefly sum up what exactly it was that they knew and pretended not to know? And by they, I mean Washington, D.C. and the leadership.
Right. Well, the main thing is we had broken the Japanese naval code. We had already admitted to breaking the diplomatic code, but this was the orders that went out to the Japanese Navy warships, and that was a major break. And that's what I confirmed. And I'm the only author that interviewed the codebreakers themselves. There's about 3,700 Pearl Harbor books, and the authors never attempted to interview the codebreakers. I was the only one.
All right. All right, just checking the clock here, seeing how much time we got. Can you tell us, please, sir, about the McCollum memo?
Yeah, one of the things that I found was that I, in searching and using the FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, which is a federal law that the Navy or the military has to respond to anybody filing an FOIA, excuse me, and I did file that in 1980. And was able to see the records by, it took about 8 years where I was able to confirm that we had broken the code and we were monitoring the Japanese messages and using radio direction finders to locate the warships that were in the North Atlantic heading from Japan along 40 degrees north latitude, really towards Hawaii, and it included the Pearl Harbor Task Force as well as submarines, and then I was able to get an interview the Navy codebreakers, and the whole story came together, and I published the book in 1999.
Right, and again, the book, everyone, is Day of Deceit: The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And I guess I want to get back to McCollum and the 8-point plan in a minute here, but I guess just real quickly here before we have to go out to this break, you write in the book, and we've spoken about this before, are you still of the opinion that it was the right thing for FDR to do this in order to get the American people to support the war?
Yes, the reason that he authorized this overt act of war, the whole idea was the McCollum, he was the Far East manager of the Far Eastern desk of the U.S. Navy, and he suggested on October 7th,
I'm sorry. We're not going to have time to discuss McCollum before this break. We'll get to that right on the other side of this
break.
Okay,
fine.
But I just meant, in your own personal opinion, you still believe that. I think it's an important point to make because people think, oh, well, he's just some old right-wing crank who doesn't like FDR kind of thing. But that's not the point of view that you're coming from here, correct?
Oh, no. I had to verify everything that McCollum said in this memo, and it took me a year to do that. And then I was convinced that we were monitoring and intercepting the Japanese naval messages.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Hang tight right there. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right of the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with historian Robert Stinnett from the Independent Institute at independent.org. Check out their Pearl Harbor resources page there and a lot of other great material. Stinnett is the author of the book Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Came out in 1999 and proves the case for the deliberate provocation and then the turning of the blind eye to the impending attack at Pearl Harbor by the FDR administration in order to get us into a war in Europe, the war in Europe, I guess I should say. So now, can you tell us very briefly here, sir, who was this naval officer McCollum? What do you know about him?
Was a graduate of the Naval Academy. He was born to Baptist ministers in Nagasaki. So he learned to speak Japanese before he learned English. And he was the one that provided the idea of the overt act of war to get Japan to commit it so it would allow Roosevelt and the United States Navy to go after Germany, which was their they were trying to do away with the isolation movement of 1940, Scott. And the idea was to get Japan to attack us at Pearl Harbor and then and thus unite Americans. And that's what happened. Mm-hmm.
And as you say, McCollum, he was a real expert because he had been born and raised in Japan, and he understood very well, and I guess as he explained in his memo, that he understood their culture very well, and I guess he thought he had a pretty good read on the military leaders as well, and basically the plan, the 8-point plan, if I count the letters right here, is meant to make the Japanese feel like they're completely backed into the corner and they have absolutely no choice but to wage what George Bush would call a preemptive strike against the American Navy before they lose their access to oil forever or that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely right. And you see, American parents were sick and tired of war from World War One, and so that's why they did not want to send their sons in another war. So the opposition was, you know, was unique. There was 80% of the public did not want to go into war. But with this sneak attack, it changed everything, and people, the young man joined the Navy on December 8th, 1941, as a result of the what they figured was an outrage. And I did also. That's why I joined the Navy.
Hmm. Yeah, that was certainly the end of the argument for getting into the war, no doubt about that. And now, it could be pointed out here as well that this eight-point plan, this Arthur McCollum memo, this is no joke. These points are things like give all possible aid to the Chinese government of Chiang Kai-shek in their war against Japan. It convince our European allies to embargo the Japanese from all oil and steel trade in the Mideast from their colonial in the Far East there and in the Indies from their colonial possessions. And this was they create a serious economic war and even a shooting war in a sense in on the Chinese end in order to provoke Japan into making this, as they call it, overt act.
That's right, and President Roosevelt sent the United States naval cruisers into Japanese territorial waters, you know, to tick off the Japanese nationalistic ideas.
And then another very interesting part of your story is the at least one Japanese spy. The way I remember, it's been a little while since I read the book, but there was this Japanese spy who was very conspicuous there in Hawaii, and the FBI was on his case from the very beginning. J. Edgar Hoover knew all about this guy. And that he was scouting out Pearl Harbor, basically picking targets, right?
Yes, that's right. He was a lone Japanese spy. He was a graduate of the Japanese Naval Academy, and he was assigned as a Japanese consulate in Honolulu. But his main thing was to spy on the Pacific Fleet, prepare bomb plot messages, and keep America advised keep Japan advised what was where the locations of the Japanese fleet or the American fleet was in Hawaii.
I'm interested, sir, whether very many of the members of the mainstream academic historical type FDR, you know, court historian community, whether any of them have been honest enough to go ahead and come over to your camp after the evidence that you've laid out in this book, or do they all just stick their fingers in their ears and scream la 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 really loud?
Well, President Eisenhower warned America of the military-industrial complex that backed all of this overt act of war plan, and most authors believe all that. But you've got to get it straight for the code breakers. And nobody did that. Nobody went to Hawaii to see the intercept stations that were not only in Hawaii, but the Pacific Coast. And I did that, and that's what convinced me that I had the right information.
Sure. Well, and this is in your book and all over, too. This has been quoted multiple times, that it's even in the diary of the Secretary of War, Stimson, that our only goal was figuring out how to maneuver them into firing the first shot so that they
That's
could
exactly
pretend
right.
to be the victim.
And your listeners can see the full memo in my book. It tells exactly what he proposed to President Roosevelt, and President Roosevelt adopted it in October 1940. Which is about a year before Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm. The eight-point plan. And, in fact, if you guys will Google up Day of Deceit, I have a blog entry at antiwar.com from 2005 that has links to all of this stuff, including a link, which I just checked, still works, to the McCollum memo. You can see it online, which, by all means, buy the man's book. I'm not saying that. But you can look at the McCollum memo right now and just look for the items marked A through H. The 8-point plan, how to provoke, or whatever it was, I forget, I think 8-point plan, how to provoke Japan into attacking us so that we can pretend to be on the defensive in this thing. It's really an incredible document. And not just the list, but also the entire memo and the context of it and everything. It's really incredible stuff. I will thank you very much again for coming back on the show, Mr. Stinnett. It's very important work and very well done.
Oh, I'm delighted to talk to your listeners.
All right, y'all. That is Robert Stinnett. The book is Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. Hey guys, welcome back now. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I got Jason Leopold back on the line here. Jason, are you exclusively at Vice now, or you're still writing for Al Jazeera? I can't keep up.
Yes, I'm exclusively at Vice. I'm their investigative reporter. Been here since August, and it's going great.
Great. Yeah, well, your reporting certainly continues to rule. So good.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan. All right, you know what? Let me ask about Hastings first.
Sure.
Real briefly here. Primary sources, emails show FBI working to debunk conspiracy theories following Michael Hastings' death. Well, now I believe in them all about 100% more. please tell me what's going on there.
Sure. So a year ago, after Michael Hastings passed away in June of 2013, my colleague Ryan Shapiro, who is a researcher and a student over at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, he does incredible FOIA work, work on the Freedom of Information Act. We teamed up and filed a FOIA request for any records that the FBI had on Michael Hastings, and we ended up suing the FBI as well for records that that the agency may have had. We did receive some records. We received one record, one file that I wrote about that showed that the FBI opened up a file that memorialized, quote, controversial reporting in Rolling Stone by Michael Hastings. And this was a story that Michael Hastings wrote about the disappearance of Bo Bergdahl. This was written well before anyone, or I should say anyone in the media, was looking into the disappearance of Bo Bergdahl. So the FBI wrote this up. It appeared to be part of a criminal investigation, terrorism investigation into Bo Bergdahl's disappearance. And it appeared that the FBI was going out and interviewing Michael Hastings' sources. And that's all documented in this three-page file. We sought more records. The FBI claimed it did not have any other records. But we did want to argue that the agency had other records based on basically inquiries that other journalists made to the FBI after he died, because there was a tweet by WikiLeaks about a day after Michael Hastings passed away claiming that Michael Hastings had contacted one of their lawyers and claimed that he was under investigation by the FBI. So many people started to surface, those who knew Hastings, those who claimed that they were interacting with him in one way or another, suggesting that he feared that, quote, the feds were interviewing his friends, and we just wanted to find out what the FBI had, what they knew, when they knew it, what was any of this true. So these documents that we received a couple of weeks ago are the last set of documents that the FBI had on Michael Hastings, and they provide insight as to, one, how the FBI was being bombarded by journalists with requests about Michael Hastings' death and whether or not the agency was investigating him. And it became very clear when you read these emails that the FBI wanted to debunk actually conspiracy theories. They said that there were conspiracy theories popping up about Michael Hastings' death, the FBI, that his death was somehow linked to the FBI, you know, an FBI investigation. So it's quite revealing, and it also shows that the FBI took the rare step of issuing a statement stating that at no time was he ever under investigation by the FBI, and they also say in these documents that in these emails that they couldn't find any files that they had on Michael Hastings. And as I just told you, Scott, in our lawsuit, we did get a 3-page file showing that the FBI looked at Michael Hastings' work on Bo Bergdahl. So it raises questions, one, about their search. Why didn't they find this file? That they were also speaking with LAPD. And so there is there's some interesting reading there.
Yeah. Well, now, so as far as what they call conspiracy theories, what's your opinion?
I don't have an opinion. I want to make it clear that I think that Michael Hastings' death is based on everything I've seen. He died in a car accident. I'm not going into any other area that somebody blew up his car, because I don't have any evidence of that. I'm a journalist, and I have absolutely no evidence to support that Michael Hastings was killed by government forces. I think that the FBI was clearly looking at his work. I think it shows that in these documents. Beyond that, I don't have anything else. So, whenever I write about Michael Hastings, or when I've written about him in the past, certainly people, they're entitled to believe what they want to believe. And what they believe is that, he was killed by the government. I don't have anything to support that. So, my job as a journalist is to try to get documentary evidence to back up my reporting. And if anyone wants to step forward with some evidence that would show that, I would be certainly happy to take a look at it.
Right on. Well, for my part, I can at least recommend to people, for their interest anyway, a lengthy interview with Michael's brother, who explains what he was going through at the time and how he is certain it was nothing but a terrible accident and that kind of thing. And of course, at any time, if the guy had died of anything other than a heart attack in his rocking chair at 82 years old, you would always be able to say that he was right in the middle of a story about something that was really important. Right, you would always be
it's
able
not
to say
that,
that
Michael.
So that correlation doesn't necessarily mean a thing. He was a badass journalist. That's why you could always make that correlation. He didn't mess around.
Exactly. I that's not to say, Scott, that Michael Hastings was not nervous about his work, about what he had stumbled upon, what he was about to report, but. Beyond that, I want to make it clear, certainly to your listeners, that as a journalist, as an investigative journalist, my job is to work with documentary evidence to support anything that I write. And I think that these documents that I have obtained, that Ryan Shapiro and I have obtained over the course of a year and a half, are very, very important. They're important in terms of historical records, and important with regard to Michael Hastings' legacy, and that he was on the radar of these government agencies. There's no question about that. I also have documents to show that many other journalists, Scott, are also on the radar of government agencies, that they're watching their work. That will be a future story. So
that's a badge of honor in the mold of Michael Hastings, if you ask me. I bet you your FBI file is something else there, Jason.
I just want to make this one quick point is that, and we spoke about this, Scott, a few years ago, I wrote a story about the brother of a high-value detainee, and I did obtain FBI records to show that, in fact, the FBI went out and interrogated him about me, about what I was asking him. So the FBI was looking into my work as well. That was very clear, so...
Right. Well, that's because you're picking your targets well, that's all. Now, here's the thing. I have to ask you at least to allow me to break my promise to you and keep you on the air here for another segment, because
sure.
I want to ask you about the torture report. But I understand if you have important meetings, you got to run out the
sure,
house.
Sure, no, let's do it.
Okay, good deal, because the music's about to start playing, and there it goes. I'll have to cut you off. So when we get back, we'll talk with the great Jason Leopold about the torture report, which may or may not come out today. The declassified redacted summary, I mean. One sec. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I got Jason Leopold on the line. He's at Vice News. And writing about the torture report here. Now, as of last week, I believe, Jason, you wrote that the torture report might come out today. You still think so?
Actually, it will be out tomorrow. So last week, you know, as you know, Scott, I believe we spoke about this before, but I have a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that I filed for this report, filed that more than a year ago. In the course of that litigation, the government has provided various updates about when the Senate intends to release it. Last week, a government attorney was due to respond to my Freedom of Information Act lawsuit on this. And the attorney informed my attorney that the response would be delayed because the Senate intended to release the report today. And on Friday, Secretary of State John Kerry spoke to Dianne Feinstein, gave her a call, and tried to delay the release of the report. At that point, the report is already being printed. There was fears that perhaps Senator Feinstein may cave into these warnings. John Kerry was basically saying, consider the timing of the report. Yesterday on the Sunday talk shows, various former CIA officials said that this report will lead to deaths and attacks, put our foreign diplomats in harm's way. A reminder that the exact same statements claims were made in 2009 when Obama was gearing up to release the infamous torture memos. Nothing happened. Mm-hmm. So at this point, grasping and considering what John Kerry had said, everyone came to an agreement that this report will be out tomorrow. In fact, the White House has already confirmed that as well. So tomorrow will be the day. 5 years in the making, $40 million. It's a 500-page executive summary. A sliver of what the full report contains, which is 6,300 pages. Mm-hmm. So it will be very interesting to see what, in fact, the Senate has found and what this report says. Dianne Feinstein called it the most significant oversight effort in the history of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Yeah. Well, and again, that's referring to the 6,300 pages. I guess we'll see what gets left in this redacted summary, but at least you got to give Feinstein some credit. She's fought to have, you know, at least some of the truth still included in the thing after they tried to black out, you know, as much of it as they possibly could. But so
absolutely.
Check this out, everybody. Wait, Jason, check this out. Y'all are going to be shocked. Jason, tell them what's not in the report, because I know you already know what they didn't even bother asking.
Well, the report does not find that it does not go into the how the torture program came to be. It does not go after the Bush administration. It does not go after John Yoo. In fact, there's no fault or blame being placed upon George Bush, Dick Cheney, John Yoo. It simply looks at the CIA. In addition to that, the report simply looks at the efficacy of torture. Does torture work? they don't even say that it necessarily doesn't work. They just simply say that the intelligence that was gleaned from detainees who were subjected to these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques mm-hmm. did not provide any valuable or unique intelligence. So they don't even ask,
did it succeed in getting false intelligence that Dick Cheney needed to justify the invasion of Iraq or anything like that?
It actually does look at that. That's, from what I understand, one of the case studies is the detainee who was tortured in, I believe it was, I'm not sure if it was Egypt, but this was in January of 2002. And the information that he provided, which ultimately led to the Iraq invasion, I think they take that apart. Mm-hmm. But the report, it should be important to know that it doesn't even use the word torture. So the does word it? Torture does not appear in it. But what the argument is that the once you read it, you will walk away, Scott, with the impression that, oh yeah, this is torture. But that begs the question as to why they did not even use the word. It doesn't even say that what they did was a violation of the Geneva Conventions, which completely contradicts Dianne Feinstein's own statements to the contrary, her own individual statement. So this report was – they put this together very carefully. They certainly put it together carefully to make sure that perhaps no one is charged or there's no – anything that would force the government to legally investigate this, on the legal side.
I wonder if the word Pentagon or Army or Rumsfeld are in there anywhere at all.
Nope. This is completely CIA.
So this is, I mean, the CIA, I am not trying to let them off the hook in any sense for the horrible things that they've done, but I think if we just... And I'm just, this is a ballpark estimate for me based on, I don't know, years of this, that, you know, overall, if we're just looking at, you know, quantity of torture, the military did about 95% of it. The CIA
Correct.
Tortured the living hell out of a few people, quite a few people, but the military tortured Afghans and Iraqis wholesale for years.
Right. We do have a report on that, though, by the way. And that came out in 2009 from the Senate Armed Services Committee. So that was a report that Carl Levin did. It's quite an explosive report. But this report simply looked at the detainees in custody of the CIA, the Black Site program, how these detainees were treated, the value of the intelligence that was obtained through the use of torture, of enhanced interrogation techniques. And that's it. And the report, or I should say the executive summary, has 20 case studies of detainees, many of which I'm sure you and your listeners will be familiar with. But there are 99 other case studies that are contained in the larger report, because there were 119 detainees in this program that, as far as we know, that we will not get to read about. We will not get to read about what was done to them. The report really singles out former CIA Director Michael Hayden for over briefings, over claims that he lied to the committee, but it does not say that Dick Cheney was responsible for anything. Even though, as I reported, that when they're looking at the history of this program, because there will be a chunk of this report that goes into the history of the program, even though the report does say that this program came to be as a result of a presidential finding in September of 2001 from George Bush. So it ends there.
Right. All right. Well, I'll let you go, man. I know you're in a hurry, but thank you for staying overtime. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. Take care.
All right, y'all. That's the great Jason Leopold. He's at Vice News, and he just sues them with that FOIA all day. He's the master of the FOIA. And he's got the documents you're looking for. Jason Leopold at Vice. And we'll be following up with him later in the week, probably, I guess, about what we found out in this thing once it comes out. And actually, it's kind of a good thing. Oops. It's kind of a good thing that I had to let him go, because there was a couple more things I wanted to say to you guys today. And I guess I could have talked about this with them, but let me just say for myself, in case you don't know, you can know. You can find out real easy all about what happened here. Read The Dark Side by Jane Mayer. Read Torture Team by Philip Sands. There are quite a few others off the top of my head. I can't remember the names of them. The Gray Zone, of course, by, Chain of Command. Chain of Command by Seymour Hersh. So what happened was the president, the vice president, the director of Central Intelligence, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, and the Secretary of State, and their top underlings and their lawyers all entered into a criminal conspiracy to violate the law and create a torture regime. And they are guilty felons. They're criminals. And they're on the loose, walking the streets right now. And that's just a fact, Jack. So I like pointing that out from time to time. As he said, well, there's this other report that from the Levin thing about the military from back then. There's the Taguba report. We got the CIA report. We don't have a comprehensive congressional report about all of this stuff together, and certainly not focusing on the administration officials most responsible. And then, damn it, I wanted to say real fast that I really wish that the white commie protesters out there would start protesting the district attorneys and the courts instead of just setting private property on fire and blocking commuters and making jackasses out of yourselves and ruining the anti-police movement like you're doing. And that's not really for the black activists. That's the white commies trying to hijack it. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.